represent a guess by the kind of people who write dictionaries about the kind of people who are likely to read them. It includes what I think people will want to look up, but it also includes some things that I think they ought to want to look up. In the end, it includes a lot about me. There are signs of an author in this most anonymous of genres. The signs, for example, of someone born in the Southwest who spent his idle youth in Latin America playing and dancing Caribbean music, who played the trumpet and liked West Coast jazz in the 1950s, who went to Princeton, who went to Spain, who earned his academic stripes as a medievalist, and, as important as any of that, who has spent virtually all of his career at Cornell. All of this in a book that says Harvard on the cover. Yes. This does not make it any better or worse than a dictionary that was just as obviously compiled by a scholar born and trained in Germany in the first third of this century. It just shows how arbitrary and personal some of the forces at work in forming the canon are. In the first instance, then, the canon that lies at the heart of this book is the canon of works that it has been thought respectable to study in the academy. This particular branch of the academy was invented in Germany in the late 19th century and then transplanted to the United States in the mid-20th. But its real keeper was writing. In the history of music, Charlemagne was probably the first person to discover the power of writing. If you want your way about what people sing and do in church, which is very useful for having your way about other things too, plaster the countryside with manuscripts. You also get your way with musicology, with musicologists 1,100 years later, though even Charlemagne was probably not grabbing for that kind of power. The kind of music from the past available for study is music that was written down, which means music produced and preserved by people and institutions of certain kinds. What was written down certainly did not include the entire repertory, even of the people who wrote it. Conversely, written music has often been part of the repertory of people who do not participate directly in written musical culture, but who participate in it socially or economically. Because written music lasted longer than other kinds, it was more easily thought of as being of more lasting value than other kinds. Until the 19th century, there simply were not large repertories of written music that needed to be excluded from the canon of what was high art, at least not in principle. What was in fact studied, that is, the canon of acceptable dissertation topics, was somewhat more restricted. Here, the specific cultural roots of the discipline show more clearly. They privilege certain periods and certain countries. This canon has not been entirely congruent with the canon preserved and transmitted by the 20th century's institutions of high culture. As recently as the early 1970s, half or more of what was submitted to and published by the Journal of the American Musicological Society was about music composed before 1600. At about that time, however, a number of leading scholars working in the 16th century leapt forward into the 18th and 19th. I took a similar leap, but since I had been working in the 11th century, I was only able to make it to the 15th. They brought their methods right along with them from the 16th to the 18th and 19th. This produced a somewhat better fit between the canon of what could be studied in the academy and the canon of what was performed and consumed as high art. In the United States, German music was central to both, though within a few years, Italian opera was also admitted to the academy as the object of critical editions, high-powered musical analysis, and the rest. All of this shows to some extent in the dictionary's treatment of Western art music, sometimes despite my efforts to prevent it. The Middle Ages and the Renaissance are still overrepresented as compared with their importance in the general musical life of the 1980s. German and Austrian music of the 18th and 19th centuries is much better represented than French or even Italian music of the same periods. But all of this makes the dictionary match reasonably well the combined activities of the music departments and concert halls of America in the domain of Western art music. The real battle over the canon is, however, an entirely different matter. It concerns all of that music, both Western and non-Western, whose primary means of transmission is not Western notation, or for which notation plays an ancillary role. Only since the late 19th century has there been, in addition, a large body of music that relies on notation, but that lies outside the domain of art music. All of this non-Western, non-art music was for a time regarded as the province of ethnomusicology. The founding fathers of musicology were a good deal more open to its study than some of their successors. For much of the 20th century, however, musicology and ethnomusicology have in fact been rather clearly separated from one another, despite the occasional call for shared methods. The first two editions of the Harvard Dictionary of Music included articles on the musics of China, Japan, India, Arabic-speaking world, and parts of Southeast Asia. These articles were for the most part accounts of the art music of those regions. The first edition included an article under the heading Primitive Music. This was published in the 40s. Right? And this article on primitive music begins, "Primitive music might be defined as the folk music of social groups which do not possess a tradition of art music, such a lack being, of course, explained by the absence of a higher cultural development in general. Wherever cultural progress has resulted in the development of an art music among the higher classes, this invariably reflects upon the folk music of the lower classes and shapes it in such a way that it cannot be considered primitive." This article also includes the remark, "It must be said at the outset that perhaps the most characteristic earmark of primitive music is one which is entirely lost in the written fixation, namely the manner of performance as practiced in the various tribal or racial provinces." Much of this belongs in a musicological version of Edward Said's Orientalism. There's respect for the high culture of certain ancient civilizations, and what cannot be written down clearly constitutes a problem. If most musicologists who studied Western art music had a big investment, stated or unstated, in notions of a canon or canons, the work of many ethnomusicologists included no such notions at all. It is not surprising, then, that the pressure for expanding the canon of what could be studied and valued in the academy came from ethnomusicology rather than from within musicology narrowly defined. Jazz, however, was something of an exception, and its case is instructive. Jazz was perhaps the first subject outside the tradition of Western art music that nevertheless began to be studied by people who did not call themselves ethnomusicologists. This was because it suited musicologists and their methods in two important ways. Although notation was not central to what was thought to be most important about jazz, the recording industry created and preserved vast quantities of source material that could be described and cataloged. And jazz prized individual creative genius. Jazz scholarship, then, turned out to be like much other musicological scholarship, strong on archival and source critical work, somewhat less strong on biography, much of it rather anecdotal, with not much in between. The question is whether this constituted an expansion of the canon or a case of attempted appropriation and domination. The expansion of the canon is more like a struggle for empire. It is a political move as much as an aesthetic one, for it serves, first of all, to incorporate foreign goods into the economy of the academy. The struggle over the canon shows itself most clearly, not with respect to non-Western music, which may be thought of as attractively exotic, or jazz, which could be made to behave like Western art music, but in the domain of Western popular music, the music that by any quantitative measure overwhelms all other kinds in our society. By popular music, I do not mean just the music of international stars on whom we might be tempted to confer the title genius, in which we've for so long trafficked, but a great many kinds of music that are part of the daily lives of a great many people. The new Harvard Dictionary of Music is the first in the series to have articles on popular music, rock, numerous subgenres and related terms such as heavy metal, reggae, and so forth. What is the significance of this? All of these items were written by university professors or future university professors. The vast majority of the people for whom this music matters will never consult this dictionary and might not learn very much new to them about these topics if they did. These additions could be said to be mere tokenism or window dressing or a marketing strategy. They could also be said to be the Academy's attempt to domesticate something bigger and more powerful, something that seems to matter more. The dictionary is filled with lots of what we could probably agree to call facts. I have probably felt the need to compile such a book because I can never remember anything without one. It tries hard, at least, to masquerade as a trophy of positivism, to describe a lot of music, if not to define it. But it also describes a field of study trying to define itself and not so sure of its motives or how to go about it.
Questions, comments, corrections of errors of fact or interpretation.
I have alas not brought the little red wagon that holds all the paper that goes in this. But I'll go home and look it up.
Yes. What proportion of entries do you give to performers living in day?
This one will not have any persons in it. This is, in that sense, a successor to the Harvard Dictionary of Music rather than the Harvard Concise. The Concise had only composers. The Harvard Dictionary first and second edition had no people of any kind, and this one has no people of any kind. That is as entries. Could it be music about music in a sort of literal sense? Yes, in a way. And one of the things that any kind of criticism of music will have to take account of is the way in which pieces are recompositions of or interpretations of other pieces. So there is certainly a deal of room for a sort of intertextual enterprise in the domain of music. In point of fact, we're not likely soon to see professors of musicology composing pieces as a way of getting at other pieces, I think. And there still is this great investment in notation as the thing that will keep us from being just words about words, right? I mean, that is, if you survey the American Musicological Society and say, what's better about musicology, if anything, than literary criticism, well, in music, we have the notes that you always have to answer to, right? And in that sense, there will be always a strong impulse to stick to the notes and to say something that is, in some sense, verifiable in the notes. But I think we have to break out of that, whether it's to the extent of composing pieces about pieces, maybe poems about pieces in some way.
A thing that I've been worrying about for some years, Don, with both respect to both literature and music, is where does literature, a work of literature, where does a work of music exist? Well, where is it? Does it exist in the performance? Does it exist in the hearer's memory? Or, you know, there's a motet by Walton that begins with the words, where does the uttered music go? And I've been wondering about
that. Well, that's clearly a first kind of question for the discipline, and I think mostly we have inclined to act as if it inhered in the notation itself. And what we have clearly learned, and we have, I mean, Cornell is one of the great centers of this kind of work, namely an investigation of the performance tradition of works along with or alongside the investigation of the source tradition, that is the notation itself. And it's clear that even if we think of the enterprise of historical performance practice as an attempt to perform works in a way that makes sense with respect to history, it is still the case even there that what guides one's interpretation of the written text of a composition is a kind of oral tradition, and it's clear that it is insufficient to say that the musical work is what's written on the page. And once you've taken that step, then it seems one opens the door to lots of things that could make writing about music a good deal more interesting than it often is.
The intent of this question is simply to allow you to expand a little bit more. A lecture that we've all found very amusing and very rich. Could you talk a little bit about how you made the decision this afternoon not to play the trumpet or sing or play any recorded music?
Well, it has to do with genre, right? And the academic lecture is a genre with its, how does it go here, with its rules, just as formal as the sestina and so forth and so on. And one does not play the trumpet or sing and dance if one is giving an academic lecture. Yet, anyway. And it's the same kind of issue that comes into making this dictionary. That is, it's in many respects arbitrary. It has to do with what you think the people who are going to pick it up are expecting to find in it. And in that sense, it's circular too. That is, it likes to suggest that it is an abstract, impartial presentation of all the stuff that's there to know, but it's in fact what you think people expect to find there, and indeed what you know yourself that you can put in it. That's not very sad. I told you it was a vicious question.
This is a related question. How would you describe the status, or define the status, of an unperformed piece of music? Or maybe I should say an unperformed piece of notation.
Well, how does one define the status or describe the status of a composition that exists in notation and has never been performed? I guess what I'm saying about that is that for purposes of, once I undertake to define it and confront it myself, it is in that sense no longer unperformed. That is, there is no sense in which I can know about it as unperformed. It only makes sense even as notation in the light of some performance tradition that I bring to bear on it. So clearly there's a lot of music that's never been performed, and historians study a lot of music that hasn't been performed in their lifetimes or within centuries, right? But they can hope to integrate that into their work.
Well, might we not say that it existed in the composer's head as soon as he thought of it, and then he notated it down?
Clearly, and there again, it's oral tradition. You see, that's the thing. We have insisted that oral tradition is something ethnomusicologists do, and written tradition is what musicologists do, roughly speaking. And it turns out, it seems to me, that oral tradition is fundamental to both of those things, and that this distinction between what's written down and what's not written down is a second-order problem. And so when we keep calling for an ethnomusicological approach to musicology, one of the things we're talking about there is, I think, de-sanctifying Western notation, however useful it may prove.
I'm curious about your inclusion of popular music in the dictionary, and to what degree is this a decision that there might be qualities in this music that are worth noting, or to what degree is it just this is facing with that because of what the majority of people listen to?
Well, it clearly is this question about the canon as what constitutes not only what things people will want to know about, but things one thinks, in some sense, worthy of knowing about. I mean, my personal view is, I have exercised a considerable amount of what would in musicology have to be called affirmative action with respect to all kinds of topics like that. Not because I think most of the traditional readers of this dictionary are for a minute going to turn to H for heavy metal first, but I hope somebody might bump into it there. And in that sense, it's sort of curious to be expanding the canon of respectable academic topics in such a book to things that many academics have nothing but contempt for. So, I mean, so far as the question of value, I'm certainly favorably disposed. I wouldn't deny it for a minute. What looks funny is the rather thin sliver of space that's devoted to such really huge topics. Now, part of the justification putting this, why not say it's just a dictionary of Western art music? Just put that on the title. And one keeps having to qualify lots of entries with phrases like that. The fact is that the tradition of Western art music in the 20th century is no longer so readily separable from those kinds of music. So on a purely practical level, there is then also the question that you can't take up Western art music, even what goes on in Philharmonic Hall, without having to do with things that had their origins well outside of Philharmonic Hall.
John, I think your readership is more popularly based than you give credit for. And I think you're going to find people turning to H for heavy metal before they turn for some other topics. And of course, you're aware of this. And this is a very interesting phenomenon, how many of the people in this group probably encountered one of those earlier editions of the Harvard Dictionary. First, as a required course for music history 101 or required course for music history, or as a graduation present from high school, I'll bet most of us did, who started out. And for that reason, I'm glad heavy metal is in there.
Well, and one has also constantly to be reducing the amount of space devoted to things that you know only six people are interested in. The thing is like the sea, right? There are these various temperatures of water, and there are lots of fish in some bands of it, and not very many fish in other bands of it. And it's true. I mean, the book is intended to be available to and useful to lots of high school students. I mean, one hopes that high school students will make some use of it. They will make different use of it from what some of the rest of us do.
How much is it going to cost?
You can always count on your friends, right? Well, the last I heard, and I don't participate in this directly, I lobbied from the beginning that it should be cheap, and the last I heard, it is going to cost $35 for a 1,000-page book. I think that's a bargain. Maybe even $32.50.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could expand a little bit on the comment that you made about text and composer helping one to establish not the correctness of the interpretation, but the possibility of the interpretation. And if you could talk about where that leaves us in terms of people who were interested in evaluating the correctness of the interpretation, especially for someone who's writing a dictionary, which seeks in some way to be the canon fodder of us all.
Well, my remarks about that were in the context of music that sets a poem, say. And what I was trying to argue about was the extent to which a composition might be a reading of a poem, lead you to an interpretation of the poem. So I might be, after hearing this piece or studying the setting by X composer, I am inclined to say, this is my interpretation of the poem. This is how I think you should interpret the poem. Clearly, in that domain, I guess I am not prepared to say that there is a correct interpretation of the poem. I'm only saying that there is some historical composer who came along after the poet and made an interpretation of that poem, which is different perhaps from the poet's, but also different from mine. And I was interested in that question as a way of sort of forcing the issue of somebody back there who makes interpretations of things or can structure my own interpretation of something without my just cooking it up off the top of my head. So that, I might be entitled to make an altogether different interpretation of that poem without the aid of the composition. But having heard the composition will in some ways impose upon me one historical view of that poem. In a way, so far as the dictionary enterprise is concerned, Kerman is of course right. That is, the dictionary does not have a lot of interpretations of individual pieces, right? So if you read the article on the chanson, you won't find an exquisite horticultural account of poem or piece. It will tend to be more summary in character, talk about the kinds of things groups of composers did, strategies of reading by composers, maybe.
Several questions, Hillary?
Yes. I was wondering, it seems to me that there's nothing natural about the way we apprehend music, that the affect and value of music is greatly conditioned by literature. So that in saying, it seems to me that in saying that the composer is sort of communicating to you another reading of the poem, aren't you mobilizing other literary texts and historical texts? And to what extent can you say that when you say the notes are there, to what extent can you say that there's something about the music itself as opposed to written language that would give you that interpretation?
Well, I certainly wouldn't include anything else, least of all literature, from that kind of oral tradition that is the basis for musical significance or the significance of the individual work. I think, according to me, the musical tradition will be the primary engine there, depending on the kinds of things we're interested in talking about with respect to music. And if you raise the question of the affective value of music, then clearly it seems to me one is talking about part of the tradition that goes along with that is words, not just other music, right? So you've gotten to the point that you know that when they play the minor chords in the background in the movies, it's sad. And you've learned that because the word sad and so forth was transmitted along with that kind of music. So it's not that you have learned that only from listening to music, you've learned that from having people tell you about that. So sure, the interpenetration between a musical tradition of hearing and a kind of literary tradition is certainly very close at moments and inseparable indeed, if I've understood you right.
A couple more questions and then you have to buy the book.
Many of us in the tradition, as it were, think of jazz as
black art music, or as black classical music, or indeed as modern classical music. And I'm always been confused about two things. One, what's art music as opposed to everything else, and how that obtained from the thing of dead, and the difference between musicology and ethnomusicology, because so much of ethnomusicology seems to be musicology applied to people, cultures, and colors. So I wonder if you could talk about both of those.
Well, in the first instance, in the case of jazz, it seems to me that historically what has happened in the study of jazz has been an application of traditional musicological methods to something that was asking to be studied for a variety of reasons. I mean, one is that when a lot of musicologists trained in the most orthodox way had grown up with jazz and liked jazz and wanted to do something about music that they happened to like in a very straightforward kind of way. What I think was unfortunate about that was that it entailed very often picking the methods off of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and plopping them down onto this thing. So one could study jazz because the tools one had at hand seemed to go with it okay. Except that there's the good chance that it left out everything that was interesting about jazz. See? And so if you, there are lots, and I mean, there are quantities of discography, and one knows lots of people who can tell you the master number and so forth for every last take by every last. And yet, if you want to go read something interesting about jazz, anything that you might think of as criticism, let's say, for want of a better word, it's hard to come by, especially if you leave out a sort of anecdotal stuff about how these people lived and so on and so on. So it seems to me that jazz criticism, really, or jazz analysis or something, is still looking to be invented or at least developed in a serious way. And that it is, in a way, a mistake, and this is what I was sort of trying to suggest about the canon, that is, it is a mistake to expand the canon to include jazz if what you mean by that was you're going to make it behave like all that other stuff you've always been studying all your life. That is, one should try to develop the methods that are adequate to its own study and perception and not simply impose on it, try to dominate it by traditional academic tools. And that seems to me always to be the problem about taking in some new repertory, unless you're really prepared to go out there and meet it. If what you do is, instead of expand the canon, you just let the canon suck something else into it, you maybe do the wrong thing. You appropriate it rather than go after it or understand it in some way. I mean, what constitutes art music is another matter which bears on money and power and institutions and so forth, and a lot of that is broken down in the 20th century, so it's not so easy to say anymore, fortunately.
Yes? The American philosopher, Eugene Rankoff, has defined music as the flow of audible feeling.
Of audible?
Feeling.
Yes, feeling.
I would like to know to what extent you might agree with that.
Well, this is the question at the heart of aesthetics. There is certainly no doubt about the physical power of music over the listener. And there is certainly no doubt about the motives of most people in listening to music. I would be willing to say that most people listen to music precisely because of that power or some effect they get from it. We are very far from understanding the nature of those mechanisms. That is, maybe from psychology the help will come in understanding that in a very well-defined kind of way. Beyond that, the thing that has kept certainly people in musicology in the mid to later 20th century from following that tack very much is that it seems very easily to fall into what is the positivist's greatest fear, relativism and so forth and so on. So although there's been a tradition of discussing music in wholly affective terms, which is not going to go away soon and is what you see in the popular press and everywhere, scholarly writing about music in recent decades has shied away from that very much, and the trend in such things and thinking about in aesthetics is quite away from Suzanne Langer in that respect.
There are refreshments up the hill in the A.D. White House. Those of you who have yet further questions can buy Don Adam with the men.